I'm Bill Crawford, and I'm an alcoholic. And sometimes you're more nervous than others when you do this. I'm scared to death tonight. John helped me a lot with that, though. That relaxed me. And one thing, this is a big deal. It's something to be nervous about. 22nd Las Vegas annual roundup's a big deal. I didn't know it would be 1,090 people paying. God knows, I don't want to hear what you had to pay for a plate of food in here. But it's a good crowd. It's an up crowd. First time I ever heard checkbook get an applause, really. And I've been to a lot of these things. So I know I can't screw up too bad if somebody will give a clap for a lost checkbook. The thing I regret most about this conference is I have and I'm going to miss too much of it. I missed Hank's talk, which I heard was just excellent, Friday night, because I didn't get here till late, and it was the only way I could make plain connections, and I'm going to miss Mary's talk in the morning, and I'm very unhappy about that, but I've got to fly out at 7:24. That's the only time they can get me to Charlotte in the morning, and I don't like that, but I certainly have enjoyed today's events and today's speaker. That Ruby was just absolutely beautiful. I sat in on the Alcathon meeting and enjoyed that, and I thought the panel, I thought relationships, what are they talking about? But it was just beautiful, and just every one of them read my mail, and I just enjoyed the people. You know, you come here, you're kind of apprehensive because you don't know anybody, but then you soon know people. The committee, in particular Karen, has just treated me like royalty and just tended my every need, and I'm certainly thankful for that, and I thank you for asking me to come and speak. With that, I think I'll just sit down. I'm telling you. I just, while I was talking, I took the opportunity to count this crowd. I was born 50 years ago in Greensboro, North Carolina, and I was born in an alcoholic home. I know the power of alcoholism from that other side. You know, if alcoholism is anywhere, certainly in a family, it's in control. It's a powerful thing, and it controlled us. Now, we didn't realize that. We couldn't appreciate that, but I know in retrospect, folks like you have taught me that what owned our family was my daddy's disease. And even when he wasn't drinking, we were dreading when he was going to drink. And when he was drinking, you know, and my daddy was a good drunk. He was not violent or abusive or mean like I later came to be. He was a good drunk, but he was embarrassing and unreliable and drank at the wrong time. And that insecurity that goes along with that was there, present in our house. He's also a Baptist. I don't know if y'all heard of that out here. Boy, once you get that, that's terminal, too. I'm telling you, that's hard to get out of that. You know, I still got a lot of that in me. And Baptists are not very complimentary to beverage alcohol, at least they didn't used to be. And so from what I lived, my experience in my home plus my religious training was alcohol was a bad thing. I didn't know anything good about alcohol. You know, my childhood heroes didn't drink. Now, you young people are not going to know who I'm talking about. But some of you will. I can see the white heads out there. I'd go down to the movies on Saturday afternoon and watch Lash LaRue and Johnny Mack Brown and the Rango Kid. These were the B-Western cowboy stars. And if you remember, they didn't drink. Not the good guys. Them bad guys didn't drink. But the good guys didn't drink. So I had a negative view of beverage alcohol coming up. I knew that I'd never drink. I knew that I would never... I knew what was wrong with my daddy, and I knew what was wrong in our home, or at least I thought I did. It was his drinking. And if he would just not drink, things would be okay. But along came something called peer pressure, and I didn't know it was peer pressure. I know now. I've, you know, read a lot of stuff like Ladies' Home Journal and stuff like that, where you learn stuff like that, and I know now it was peer pressure. And it's a little story I usually tell in my talk. I was in downtown Greensboro back when people came to downtown Greensboro. Now they're all out at the malls and shopping centers. But at that time, everybody on a Saturday was down there, and I was down there. And out in front, I was about 14 years old, out in front of Man's O'Henry Drugstore with three of the finest-looking boys I'd ever seen in my life, older than I. Let me tell you how they looked. They stood there, and the shirt collars were standing straight up. their hair was combed back on the sides and squared off in the back. And they wore their breeches real low, and the breeches were real big in the knee and real small at the cuff, these draped breeches. I was the greatest thing I'd ever seen in my life. You could tell they were rebels. And I got up with somebody, and I said, "What is that?" And they said, "They're cats. That's what they're called." I wanted to be a cat worse than anything in the world. Now, I had already, this peer pressure thing had been at work with me all along. I'd learned how to smoke Lucky Strikes. And I was doing a pretty good job of inhaling, too. It was important to inhale back then. I don't know if you remember that or not. And I remember I worked real hard, and inhaling didn't come natural to me. I remember I had to really work at that. I can remember it hurt me so bad to inhale that I'd only do it if somebody was looking. I don't know if you can identify with that. If I'd be with the gang and we all had our luckies lit, if somebody would turn my way, I'd grab a post and inhale a big drag and look cool. So I was inhaling pretty good, and I was sort of, sort of tough and that kind of thing. And there were the cats. So me and old, and I'm sure he wouldn't mind my using his name, me and old Charles Deligny, he sort of advised me on how to be a cat. And I don't want to dwell on this too long, but I'll just say I became a cat pretty quick. I got me some pants with the big knees and the little bottoms, and I got my mama to starch my shirt collar so they'd stand up. Had a little hair problem. I had real fine hair, still do. It just wouldn't. That was in the day of Wild Root Cream Oil, if you remember that. I put a half a bottle on it, and it still would just kind of fall down. And old Deligny introduced me to a product called pomade. I had so much trouble. You know what pomade? The blacks of that in that period were using pomade, and of course some of us cats used it too. Let me say this about pomade, in case you're too young to know what pomade. You may have seen the Final Net hairspray ad on TV, and they've got the gal with the hairspray, and she goes through a real rough day, and at the end of the day, she's pooped, but her hair's still in play. That tickles Final Net to death that hair stayed together. Pomade holds your hair for 3 months. They say if a train hit you and if they found your head, your hair would be in place. I say all that to say this. I made my way down there in front of Manzo Henry with the rest of those cats, and you know what all this means or what I'm leading up to. The drug of choice or the drug that was available then was beverage alcohol. And I began to drink simply because the need to be like these people, to be included with these people, was greater than my fear of the drug alcohol. And that took a lot because I was really afraid of alcohol. I really had a contempt for alcohol. But the need to be included in this bunch was more important, a stronger pull, if you will. And so I began to drink. And this is my social drinking period. I'm kind of proud of this. It didn't last long. So you have to listen back. I drank, and I don't remember what it was. It might have lasted 2 months. It might have lasted 3 or 4 months. It was that period that I took a little swallow of this or a half a can of that, and until I reached that night when I was 15 and a half years old that I got enough in me to feel it. I'd never felt it before. And it did something for me that I wouldn't attempt to describe to any other group of people. And I've had the privilege of talking to groups of professional people and the Rotary Club and all those things that some of us end up talking to, and I never attempt to describe. You know, about half of you or a little over half of you know exactly what I'm talking about. It did for me something that, it was like something had been missing. There was a hole there that this filled up, and I've heard you describe it in much the same way. And it just, I just assumed it did this for everybody. I assumed for everybody it put the world out where it belonged. It made them a part of. It made them enough. I was tough enough and smart enough and good-looking enough and included enough. I was just enough when I was on this stuff. And that's what I thought it did for other people. I sense and learn better. Only about 1 in 10 of us apparently get this at some point in our drinking, this wonderful reward. And so I became preoccupied with drinking, with alcohol right then. Didn't know it. I would bet if we use our description, our definition of alcoholism out of our book of experience, the big book, and we believe that alcoholism is that physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession, a mental compulsion, then I was half an alcoholic from the very first. I was down at the old downtown cemetery there in Greensboro where we'd sneak down in and do all sorts of things, and we were sitting down there drinking old Mr. Mack wine, and I felt it, and the moment I felt it, I was half an alcoholic. The mental obsession was there that night. And I didn't realize it. I know now, looking back on it, that I set about to drink at every opportunity. And when I wasn't drinking, I was looking forward to drinking. I made sure that I went where drinking was going to be going on, and I made sure I associated with only those people who drank. Half an alcoholic. The physical allergy wasn't there in the beginning. It didn't take long. My whole drinking career was not a long career because I hit the ground running. I didn't have that period like some of you have. You know, where I drank okay for 15 years or whatever, and then I crossed the invisible line. I was standing on that invisible line when I was at that old cemetery and felt it for the first time. And life went on. Now, there was that nagging fear and guilt that was there. I shouldn't be doing this. This is bad. It's not only evil, and I've learned that religiously, but it's also something that's going to get me like my father. It's something that may turn on me like my father, but I would rationalize and say, I'm not going to do this forever. I'm just having a good time. And when I'm older and when I set out to be a man, I'm not going to drink. Or I'm going to drink like those people I'm learning about that don't drink and have trouble. I'm going to have that mixed drink and have the Great Dane dog at the fireplace or whatever I thought, you know, grown people that succeeded in drink. But I would put that day forward, and life went on. And I'm going to try not to bore you with a long drunk-a-log, but, because I don't have a long drunk-a-log, but I life went on. And it was still doing great things for me. You know, what it does for us is what gets us in trouble with it, and what it does to us is what gets us here, hopefully. And then it was doing a lot for me. The scale seemed to be tipped way in favor of the reward and not the price. Well, I was doing right much vomiting and stuff till I got it right. There were those things, and I had some embarrassment, and I had some scrapes with authority, situations and circumstances that I wish hadn't happened. But basically, it was doing so much for me and very little to me. And later, when it seemed to be demanding its price, when it seemed to turn on me, I just almost missed it. Now, the blackouts or that amnesia I had right from the beginning. I didn't know that I was having amnesia or blackouts in the beginning. I just thought people would mix me up with somebody else. I don't know if you had that. I'd get a report on something and something I'd done or something. I hadn't even been there. Amazing things. But they'd always have a witness. You know, I would say, no, it wasn't me. And they'd say, well, come here, Joe, and tell Crawford here that it was. And I would hear this thing, and I'd say, well, I did. I was there, and I did that, and I forgot it. But see, I didn't know that that was peculiar to alcoholics. I didn't know that this blackout thing was something that we get and normal drinkers don't get. I wanted to think that all drinkers, when they drink too much, forget. I started at one of the things that was sort of subtle or seemed to be, I started being less and less able to predict the amount I was going to drink. I would set out to drink a little, and I wouldn't drink a little. I'd drink a lot. And by then, I'm married. You know, we always do that, don't we? Always. That's how it becomes a family disease. You know, very few of us will go off and be an alcoholic on our own. We got to take some hostages in there and screw up everybody. And I had gone to a very little bit of college. And I know now how much my drinking or the alcoholism interfered with any kind of education I might have gotten. But I went into the military. It was something you better do in my time or you couldn't get a job. And I joined the Army. And they made, just so you'll know you're hearing from a professional tonight, I'll just say this to impress you, they made me a neuropsychiatric technician. I see a look of awe on a lot of faces. Most of you can't even spell neuropsychiatric technician. Now, I was one. Now, what that is, that's a keeper in a nut house is what that is. And by then, I'm rocking along with a lot of, I mean, my alcoholism is going full course. Now, to give you an idea of what a neuropsychiatric technician is in the Army, so you can picture it, if you'd walk on one of these wards, let's say, at the old Valley Forge General Hospital up there in Phoenixville, and there you just walked in cold, you didn't know anything, the nuts were in blue pajamas, and we were in white clothes and we carried keys. So if you'd wondered who to back up against the wall with, we were in white. And they taught me, I remember I went through a training course, and they taught me just enough psychology to worry about it. I don't know. I don't know if you've ever had that kind of, when I'd hear about things like schizophrenia, and I know secretly, my God, I feel that way, you know? But you can't let them know. And that's a big secret to know. But I'm just as crazy as these nuts. And I'd stand there on that ward about to go have these panic attacks. And some of you know what that is. I'd say, it'd be a shame to flip out and then switch my suit, you know? And it embarrassed me in front of the other people. But that night when I would leave the ward and go to the club, things would change. Now this is where I stop and give a quick little educational course on alcoholism. Some of you want to go to work in it. Some of you are already working in the field and making your living at it, and some of you aspire to do that. So I stop and give a quick bachelor's degree because they've done a lot of research on us. They have gotten rats drunk for years and studied us and this kind of thing. And I always thought it was interesting. All these billions of dollars they spent on, and they should. I mean, we have a disease, so it should be researched. I always thought it was interesting that with all that money they researched on us, they never spent a dime researching them non-alcoholics, you know? So I've taken it upon myself. Since there's no government grants coming down for the study of non-alcoholism. And it's been fairly simple because I'm married to one of the worst cases of non-alcoholism you've ever seen in your life. I mean, this is, latter stage non-alcoholism. You know what I mean? And ASK she'll drink a little now. You know, we'll go out to a restaurant maybe two or three times a year. She'll have a half a glass of white wine or something. And over the years, and we've known each other for 100 years, but we've been married 29 years, over the years, she's probably drunk enough to feel it. Four times. Maybe. And you know what she does, and this is going to disgust the newcomers, so brace yourself for this one. You know what she does when she starts to feel it? She stops. That demands research. So I've looked into it. You know what she says, and I ask her, and I've analyzed this thing, and basically what she says, the bottom line is she quits because she doesn't like that feeling. You know what she thinks when she starts getting that feeling? You know how you get the pilot lit, you know, when you get that, you know what I'm talking about? When she gets her pilot lit, if she even has one, she feels like she's losing control. When I would leave that nut board and go up to the club after thinking I'm going to fly apart all day and they're going to learn my secret, I would start ingesting that stuff, and for the first time that day, I would be in control. You know, I'm satisfied, all kidding aside, I'm satisfied that that's all the difference I need to know between me and them. is the same stuff that makes them feel that they're losing control was the only thing that gave me any semblance of control. And even when it was clear it was doing these things to me at times, and later on it got at times clear, I still had to have that control. It seemed to give me because it was the only thing I had. So I was losing control of my drinking. Now, I didn't know that. I didn't know that I was losing control. I just think I'd screw up now and then. Yeah, we are. I just didn't mean to do that. I didn't mean to stay out all night. I didn't mean to drink that much. I didn't just mean to start drinking liquor. I wanted to just drink beer. It could happen to anybody, you know, this kind of thing. Another thing, and I think this is real similar with all of us, or at least if I understand the stories you've been telling me over the years, I started losing control of my behavior, too. I could not predict my behavior. I might be funny in the life of the party, which I wanted to be, but more and more often I was becoming hostile and mean. And I was doing and saying things that I didn't want to do and say. And there's the shame and the remorse, the guilt set in because of this. And it became evident to me at times that something's wrong with my drinking. Now it would become evident to those around me a lot sooner that there's something wrong with my drinking. And I begin to get the fingers pointed, or at least that's the way it seemed. Why do you drink so much? Don't drink so much when we go tonight. Don't drink so much. Why don't you drink like so-and-so? This kind of thing. And I would resent that, and I would defend and all that kind of stuff when they were attacking me and everything, but secretly I would say, well, I'm going to do that. I'm going to correct it. I'm going to be better. I'm not going to let that happen again, by golly. I'm not going to do that again. I'm not going to that place again. I'm not going to embarrass myself like that again. Then I started getting those hangovers along in there some. I thought I'd been having hangovers. But what I'd been having wasn't a hangover at all. There was a whole new thing waiting out there for me. And you know, some of you know what I'm talking about. Oh, real hangovers. The hangovers that make you look back fondly on what you used to call hangovers. It's like I'm non-alcoholic hangovers, you know? You know, if you got anybody you work with or anybody in the neighborhood, the family, I'm non-alcoholic, and they go out on New Year's Eve, whenever those people drink. And they really tie one on. They have their 6.5 drinks or whatever they have. And they brag about them hangovers. Boy, I was telling you, I woke up New Year's morning, I was just dying. My head was throbbing. My tongue felt like a foot. I could barely eat my waffles. You know, that's a serious hangover to those guys. But I'm talking about those real deals, you know, where you come to and you don't wake up and every fiber of your being is screaming for more of this stuff, whether you know it or not. And the only person in the world was me, and the fear and terror is indescribable. And I got into morning drinking. I discovered the morning drink. That's the term. I discovered the morning drink. Thank God, by the way, I discovered the morning drink. I've heard a lot of stories from podiums like this and heard, you know, I lost 15 families. A lot of sad stories, but the saddest thing, the thing that really gets my gut is those of y'all that never discovered the morning drink. I want to grab you and hug you after you talk, I tell you. I couldn't have stood that. Now, of course, the morning drink turned into the, and I'm going to try to hurry through this thing a little bit, and it became bender drinking. Now, I'm not talking about somebody in his 40s or even his 30s. I'm talking about somebody in his 20s. And since Greg, who was with me in Texas a few years ago, who heard me talk at a conference there, since he was nice enough to ask me to tell one of these stories, I'm going to tell it because this sort of goes along with this part of my drinking, this period of my drinking. I was looking for ways, like we always do, just like we were heard out of chapter 3. I was looking for ways to have it, what it's doing for me, without paying that price of what it's doing to me. I had to have what it was doing for me, but what it was doing to me was becoming bigger and greater and more severe. And I was looking at all kinds of ways. And every once in a while, I would discover ways to drink and not get in trouble. I don't know if you know that feeling. It's the most wonderful feeling in the world. You know, it's like discovering beer. you know, and that you can't be an alcoholic on beer and this kind of thing. Well, I was about 24, 25, young fellow, married with a couple of children, and I'm looking through Esquire magazine. And they have all the nice ads in there, and I opened up Esquire to a double-page ad, and they didn't even have a pretty girl or the guy with the graying temples or anything. There was no people in there. It was just a glass with a green liquid in there and crushed ice. Beautiful. Little bubble of sweat going down the glass. You know how that is? And it said mint julep. And it was advertised, and I don't know what it was advertised. It was advertised one of these sour mash bourbons, or it was advertising the brand of cream de mint. I don't know. But I was so impressed. And it even got a little recipe over there. You took a jigger of the cream de mint and a jigger of the sour mash bourbon, and you did that, and you had your mint julep. And I was talking at some deal a few years back, and some lady said this was a bad recipe for mint juleps, but by God, it was a recipe in Esquire that day. So I just couldn't wait. It was a Friday. And when I left the office, I stopped by the liquor store, and I didn't get the Rebel Yell or the Wild Turkey or what it was. I got me a pint of George Stagg, old Stagg, which was a little bit cheaper, and a pint of cream de mint. And headed home with my brown sack to do some dignified drinking. Now, by then, I'm getting a lot of trouble with drinking, and when I walked in with that familiar-looking sack, Kay gave me that look. She hadn't seen the ad, and she thought I was going to get drunk. And I said, no, we're going to have, including her, we're going to have mint juleps. I said, I've been getting drunk Friday nights and all weekend, but I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to sit and drink some mint juleps. We lived in an apartment complex, and it was a warm summer evening, and the other couples, young couples, were some of them were sitting out back. And I remember there was a couple of gals there, and I hollered out the screen door, would you gals like to have a mint julep? Well, they were delighted. I said, I'll mix you one, and Kay wouldn't have any part of it. Didn't have an ice crusher, but I wrapped a dish towel around the ice and beat it with a hammer. Have you ever done it? And beat up some ice and made three mint juleps, and I walked out and joined these gals, and we sipped our mint juleps. And I remember the feeling that I'm drinking okay now. In fact, I kind of hated the taste of that cream de mint, and I kind of felt like you're drinking something you didn't like. It was kind of nicer. And so I drank mine faster than they drank there. And I went back for it. And as a matter of fact, I can remember how that crushed ice kind of lumped up to one lump. It just stayed in there so long, melting in it. And I may have had two or three before they were able to get theirs down. I offered them another one. No, they didn't want any more. But I continued to have mint juleps. And I felt good about it. And I can remember along about the sixth one, I beat holes in that towel. And Katie won't be beating up any more towels. So I said, you know, in the ad it was crushed ice, but you know the cubes chill it just as well. Put the cubes in there, swirl that stuff, and sipped on it. At 10:30, I ran out of ice. But you know what I discovered? You could just put a jigger of each, warm. It was fine. Sort of a mint julep toddy. It's a good thing. Lost the glass about 11:30. You know, my glasses will roll under things. You know what you could do, though? You could take a slug of the bourbon and chase it with the cream of the mint, and it mixed just as good. Kay thought I was going to get drunk. My teeth stayed green for about a day and a half. So, you know, I like all of us have untold number of stories like this, the craziness, that crazy way that I'm going to do it different this time. And life was bad, and life wasn't funny. And life was sick. And my family was becoming sickened by this disease like my family of origin had become sickened by this disease. And we were all doing crazy things. I'd gone away. I was working in some crooked company because I had gotten my employment. My resume was getting a little weaker. And I was working for this crooked company. I was up in St. Louis, and I stayed drunk up there for 2 weeks, and I came back. And I was in trouble, and I knew it, and I was sick, and I just knew I needed weeks, and I came back. And I was in trouble, and I knew it, and I was sick, and I just knew I needed to do something. And I needed to make some grandstand move. I needed to make some promise to her to get the heat off. Do something. Say something. And I was, and she left the house for some reason, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And this was in the middle of the summer of 1966. And by then, you know, I'm standing, I'd always drink down to my underwear, you know, and I would get that morning to night, around the clock type drinking, bender drinking. And I was in that underwear that I was always in. I just didn't, there was two things that I didn't do while drinking, two things that ruin a buzz, and most of you know it. Baths, and food. And I didn't take any baths, and I didn't eat any food. And, of course, you know, you can imagine what my breath was like from the no food, and you can imagine how gamey the rest of me was from the no bath. And my wife, Aunt Pearl, as a joke, would make this funny, crazy underwear. She'd give all the men in the family. It was a joke. Yeah. Hearts in the rear, some obscene stuff I won't even share with you, but lace around them. And just kind of a joke. It was no joke with me. I was not investing a lot in underwear, so this is all the underwear I had, which is an accumulation of Aunt Pearl's shorts that she had made over the years for Christmas. And if I picture myself, it'd be in Aunt Pearl's drawers with a crotch down at my knees, oversized, and a T-shirt I hadn't changed, a little vomit down the front. And this day, in that condition, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And a fellow by the name of Bill N., who was and is an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, he called me back. I connected with answering service there in Greensboro, and he called me back. And we talked, and I was tapering off. You know about tapering off? Yeah, some of you might. Tapering off. My daddy used to taper off. I later got real proficient at tapering off. And I would drink, and then I knew I just couldn't quit abruptly, so I would taper off. I would, you know what I'm saying? Y'all know what I'm saying. But Kay didn't know what I was saying. She would confuse tapering off with drinking. I don't know if you know anybody. You know the difference. But see, she just didn't have that kind of mind where she could understand that. You know, she'd say, you said you were going to quit drinking yesterday. And I'd say, I did quit drinking yesterday. Today, I'm tapering off. It's a whole, I'm just giving myself a beer every hour or something. Of course, a couple of times I did have a dosage problem there, and I'd get plumb drunk tapering off. I don't know if that ever happened to you. And, of course, nothing to do but start over. So I might pull a three-day drunk and then taper off for two more weeks. And I wasn't getting to work every day under these conditions, and things were bad. And so I called AA. And Bill and I talked, and he could tell I was tapering off. And he was about as narrow-minded as Kay was about taping off, and he didn't want to rush to my aid. And we made an agreement that I was going to be back in touch with him. Now, we were getting ready to leave town. Okay, you know how wives and husbands and family of alcoholics plan all the trips and everything like things are normal. And she had planned, God love her, the beach trip. We were going to go down the next day and spend a week. And he said, when you're down there at Long Beach, call AA. It's down there. When you come back, call me. And here's my name, and here's my number, and I wrote it down. And when Kay came back to the house, I had it. A name and a number from somebody at the A&A to show her. Before she could open her mouth, I said, I have called the A&A. Here's the man's name, here's the man's number. Hush. Now, he and I agree I'm not ready yet, but he said, he said, should I be? He wanted me to call. I said, hold on to this. Now, if you drink like I drink, and you hand your wife or anybody a number and a name of somebody that might help you, you don't need to tell them to hold on to this. She'd have let the youngins go first. See, that that name and number was going to stay there. And, of course, I did not call him back. But at one of those times in our home, and I don't need to tell you what that's like, one of those desperate times, one of those painful times, she called. And this was maybe 4 or 5, maybe even 6 months after I'd made that original call, and she called and she got him on the phone and she explained who she was, and I had talked with him some months earlier. And he listened with empathy, and he listened as we do, but he did the big thing, the important thing, when that other, that family member called. He said, hold the phone. He went and got Lib, his wife, who was big in Al-Anon, and she got on the phone and told Kay about Al-Anon. The game changed. I'm okay. If you're drinking and your spouse gets an Al-Anon, it probably won't cure your drinking. It's not designed for that. But it'll break your rhythm, I'll guarantee you that. Things change. She began to change. Now what she began to do is begin to recover from alcoholism. She began to be free of my disease. That's all it was. That's all, you know, if somebody in that mess gets into recovery, things are going to be better. Things are going to change. And God love her, she did. Al-Anon has as much more to do with my finding this program than anything else. Because although I could not appreciate what was going on, I was watching somebody get well right before my eyes. I was watching alcoholism lose its grip on someone. Even though that's not, I didn't understand what I was seeing. On June the 2nd of 1967, I'm sitting there coming off another one of these drunks. It's not even a particularly exotic one. I'd been in a hell of a lot more trouble on others. Maybe even sicker on some others. I don't remember, but I was just there again, and the only person in the world and full of that terror and full of that pain. And I turned to her and I said, let's call that man again. And she had learned enough in Al-Anon that she wasn't supposed to do it for me, but she also knew when I was coming off those drunk, that's back when the telephone had them holes in it, you know, didn't have the button. And she knew I couldn't run her around 7 times like that. So she did dial and got him on the phone and handed me the phone, and I can remember what he said. So he knew about me. He knew about the disease anyway, but he had kept up with me through Kay and Lib. He said, are you about ready to throw in the towel now? And I said, yes, I am. And I think I was telling him the truth as much as I knew the truth. And he said, I'll see you in the morning. This was a fairly late hour. And he came to that house. I'm a homeowner. That's part of my denial. I'm a homeowner. Now, the mortgage company was working real hard to change that. We were about 2 weeks from the courthouse steps, if you're ever in one of those houses. And he came into that almost foreclosed upon house and sat in that little old living room and did what we do. And he did it beautifully. But the main thing he did is he made that deal. I hope we're still trying to make that deal. I know a lot of us are rushing out now since they got Blue Cross so we can throw them down there in treatment. But the first thing I think we ought to do is try to talk to them about Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what he did. And he wanted to be the example that he was proof that, and he was. And I couldn't deny that he was a pretty clean cut and nice looking fella. And things seemed to be going well for him. And I was convinced of that. And he made that deal that I hope we always try to make. Number one, that I would not drink that day, and this was a Saturday morning, and that I would go to Alcoholics Anonymous with him that night. Isn't that what we try to do? And I agreed. I'd agreed to anything. I was about ready for him to leave. You remember when they came to see you? You know, you just talk and talk and talk. That's what it seems like, and it's just time for them to go. My attention span was short. And so, you know, if he'd have said, well, we, you know, we have to take your ear as a deposit, I said, fine, cut off ear. You see, I was too sick to go to a meeting that night. I wanted to go. I was going to go next week. I was too doggone sick. But I kind of had a feeling he didn't want to argue about that, so I would just send him, we could explain to him later. But see, Kay heard that deal. She had her ear pressed to the door, so we had to go. So I got in the old Mercury that Wachovia Bank was trying to take back from me, and we went over to the Starmount Group on June the 3rd of 1967. It was a speaker meeting. Most meetings were in Greensboro at that time. Of all the meetings in town, only two were discussion meetings, or what we call closed meetings. The rest were speaker meetings. And I went into a meeting in the Starmount Presbyterian Church that I want to tell you just a little bit about, and I hope I never get a podium between my hands that I don't talk about this meeting. You know, I think everybody has his or her first meeting. It may not be the very first one you go to, but the first one that lights your fire. It may be the 50th. For me, I think through this moment that my first meeting was my first meeting. I walked in, I remember old Homer Key was chairing the meeting, and he was greeting people as they came in. And I walked in, it was a much small meeting, 18, 19, no more than 20 people, and I walked in this real nice room. And the people got up and did what we do, like they did tonight, and read that stuff. And an old boy got up to some applause and told the story that I'm telling tonight, and the story that I've heard 5,000 times in between. The story we tell. And two big miracles occurred in my life that night. And I couldn't appreciate them in present time, but I know in retrospect, two big deals happened in my life. Now, Al had been sober one day. Remember what that's like? Anything I was hearing, I didn't need to be tested on. But number one, I understood this old boy's message. What he was telling me and those 18 or 19 other people was that he had drunk alcohol hopelessly. That he'd come here to this thing, and he wasn't drinking, and life was good. And I don't remember how long that was. I just remember that was the message. And number two, a bigger miracle was that I believed every word he said. And I hadn't believed anybody or anything in so long I couldn't tell you. I didn't even believe in God. I certainly didn't believe in do-gooders or self-help programs or any of this stuff. But I believed every word this rank stranger said to me. He had no reason to have any credibility with me. Now, psychologists could have a big time with that, I guess. Most of us in here call that the grace of God. I was hooked on Alcoholics Anonymous without knowing it, in much the same way I was hooked on alcohol without knowing it. Now, I didn't have a whole lot of other places to go. Now, I deal with a lot of people now that have to schedule in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have to explain down at the country club what I was going to be doing. This was not my problem. I did not have a job. I did not have a society. Now, the first thing that hooks us is the fellowship. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is first, isn't it? You know, when we read the preamble, Alcoholics Anonymous is the fellowship. If they'd have said, if you had said to me, we're going to mail you some steps in a book here and you work those things, you'll be fine. And I couldn't have made it. I had to get hooked on you all. And you hooked me. After we finished that thing, I didn't pick up one of these starter chips. I didn't going to play it cagey. I didn't want to pledge anything that night. But we made our way from that room over to what they call the Fellowship Hall of the church, and it had cake out there and had all this coffee. And they were standing, I hadn't had coffee in a long time. Coffee made me nervous. That's what I tell people. It often makes, no thing, coffee makes me nervous. And it did, you know. Sometimes just getting around it made me nervous. And I didn't like sweets. You ever notice when you talk to a girl, I don't like sweets, never had this kind of thing. So I didn't eat cake and I didn't drink coffee. But all of them did, you know. They all had them a cup of coffee, big old cup, and a hunk of cake. It looked like it's about a quarter of a pound of cake. And they come up and say something, and spit them crumbs out there.
I mean, you could tell they were enjoying it. Slop some coffee in there behind it. And that was my first ambition. It wasn't even to get one of those big cars I saw in the parking lot. I want to eat me some cake and drink some coffee. Right. Doesn't take long. Don't drink for about a week or 10 days. I had me a newcomer. I was spitting cake crumbs on him. Tell him don't keep coming back. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the society, the men that surrounded me in this program. You know, when one of the old sayings that we hear and we still hear, and it's a good one, pick the winners. The winners picked me, I guess. I don't know if I could have determined who was a winner or a loser right there from the start. I think it doesn't take long to make that determination. But these guys, much my senior, I was 29 years old. And these men were at least in their mid-40s and some almost as old as I am now. And they took me up and down the road with them. They were committed to sobriety, committed to this program. And these men had what I wanted. These men had that thing that, sure, they had nice cars, they had jobs, and they had suits and pants that matched and all that business. But they had that look that we try to describe, that look of peace. Yeah, it didn't take long, and it doesn't take any of us long to separate who the winners and who the losers are. You can be around here for a couple of weeks, and no old-timer has to get you off the corner and say, that guy vomiting over there is a loser, and that guy over there with, you know, sponsoring a half a dozen people is a winner. And you know that. You can compute that. And I wanted to have what these winners had. I wanted to interview them, you know, and I would corner them, and maybe that's good. And I wanted somehow, and in fact, Greg and I were talking today in my room, not Craig, but Greg, and we were talking about a mutual friend, and we were talking, and he's never made the program, not really, and he was the type that wanted me or someone else to do the program for him. You ever run into that kind? They want me to go to the meetings, or want you to go to the meetings and work the steps, and then they come talk to you and let you osmosis it to him. And I wanted that kind of thing. And I discovered that thing I hope we all discover. All winners do the same thing. There's no secret. I knew they were going to tell me something, you know. After 6 months, call me on the side and say, Crawford, you know, we work these steps and we go to the meetings. But when there's a full moon, we take a dead cat and bury it in the backyard, you know. I mean, there was some mystery they weren't sharing with all just everybody that came strolling in the door, you know. But that didn't happen. And then I discovered that thing, that all winners are doing the same thing. You look around. Take the people that, if you're new, take the people that have that thing you want to have. Take the people that you admire. Use as example those people that you'd like to be in their shoes. And even though you think, as I thought, well, they just got it made. If they had my troubles, you know, they wouldn't be feeling that good and walking around grinning all the time. Even though you think that, just take all these people and make a list of what they're doing. And I bet you're going to find out what I found out. All winners go to a lot of meetings. And they're active in the meetings. You know, they're not just there. They're not spectating. They're there as part of it. They're members. You know, they're chairing the group and they're emptying the ashtrays and they're taking an active part. All winners talk about this book that we call the Big Book. And even can even sort of know what it says. I don't mean big book quoters, but sort of have a gist of what's in there. And all winners express the spiritual feature freely. We talk about God and the spirituality of this program. And all winners, I think, work the essence of this program, which I believe is the 12-step spiritual part of the program, in one way or another. And most winners will carry this message to a still suffering drunk under any reasonable circumstance at any time. Because I discovered what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about after going through a lot of agony and pinning down some of you old-timers that I thought really had it and interviewing you and trying to learn the secrets and following you around and trying to hear what you're saying, see if I couldn't sit in your chair and get some of that stuff to rub off of me and all those things. I had a sponsor then. I've now moved from that town to have a new sponsor, but the first 15 years of my sobriety, I had one sponsor, old Rupert, called him Granddad. And Rupert was a 12-stepping drunk. And he would carry this message to some of the god-awfulest places you've ever seen in your life. And we made a lot of mistakes during that 12th. I know now, looking back on it. I remember one guy we kept drunk for about 3 days trying to taper him off, you know. I remember those days. There weren't so many places you could dump them, detox places, and we kept old Sam. It about killed me and old Homer. Rupert had us over pulling shifts with old Sam. Sam looked like $1 million singing Rock of Ages on his front porch. And I came over at shift change with Homer, and both of us had dark circles under our eyes. We'd been up with Sam for about 3 or 4 days, and I said, Homer, let's go home. I won't tell Rupert if you won't. Well, Sam's doing fine. And we went home and Sam got sober. We kept doling it. We quit doling out that liquor to him. But old Rupert would call me, and he didn't ask what I thought the person might be motivated or anything. He would just call me and say, I'm going to come pick you up and we're going to go. And it might be the Greenwich Hotel or something. One of the rotten place where nobody ever wanted to get sober. But then we'd go if the call came in through answering service, and I don't know how many calls I made with him and how many people I would sit over at his house. He'd bring them to his house, and we'd sit out in his backyard or in his kitchen and talk to that drunk maybe all night long about this program. And I'm sitting somewhere at some time with somebody who's hurting worse than me. And a strange and new but beautiful feeling overcame me. I didn't know what it was, and it didn't last long, and I couldn't really identify it until sometime later, until I got away from the situation. And I looked back on it, and I realized for the first time in my life, for a couple of seconds, I cared more about someone else than I did me. Just for a little piece of time. And it's the best feeling I ever had. Now, I'm not talking about since drinking. I'm talking about in my whole life, I had never cared more about you than I did me for any period of time. And that's when I discovered what y'all have been trying to tell me all along. That my problem is self-centeredness, selfishness. It's not the kind of booze I drink. It's not the kind of genes I got from my alcoholic daddy. It's none of these things. My problem is self. And this whole recipe for living implied in these 12 steps the business is eliminating me, getting rid of self. Now I can have that feeling anytime I want it, anytime I need it. All I got to do is reach out. All I got to do is be responsible. All I got to do is understand what the 12th step means. And I can be free of me. The formula is simple for me. The emptier I am of me, the fuller I am of God. If I come to a big deal conference like this, I got to realize this is a big deal, but I ain't a big deal. And if I start thinking it's up to me that this Saturday night banquet goes well, then that's back into self. And I'm going to kill myself once again with that. That's the cancer that's going to eat me up if I allow it, if I get away from this regimen that you've taught me. So many good things have happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I raised my children in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was talking in Al-Anon. We raised our children in the program. And I was talking to somebody, I can't remember who, but I was talking to somebody earlier here that had small children, or they were talking about small children. I said, yeah, but watch out, they're going to turn into teenagers. You know, they do. And until somebody comes up with a way to freeze them or something and then thaw them out later, that's what, yeah. So I don't get into advice, but I'll give you just a little bit of advice. If you've got children that are heading into the teens, and you don't like this program, find yourself some program. Because you need something. But we did that, and we survived that. I can remember that our 18-year-old daughter, when she was 18, had to be kicked out of our house. And that was the toughest thing we ever had to do. Ever had to do. And I won't go into all the details about that. I'll just say now at age 26, she and Kay are each other's best friends. They talk to each other every day on the phone. Kelly's in Greensboro and we're in Charlotte and have been for quite a few years. The closeness to love is beyond our wildest imaginings. And we were able to make the decision and tough decision of asking her to leave the house or making her leave the house because of this program and the reunion. The recovery from that was simply because of this program. Many tough things. I've been fired since I've been sober. You know, I thought I'd never be. I'd been fired drunk. Lord, that was no big deal. I'd just get, sometimes I'd be fired not know it. I just hadn't dropped back by. You know. So that was no big deal. By God, I got fired sober. I've been sober 2 years and three quarters. Doing a beautiful job in AA, too. I like to say, sort of an AA poster child at that time. You know, the kind I was chairing a lot of meetings and making talks and sort of a pillar of the discussion groups. You know, I had more to say, and I was really active, made coffee. And they fired me. The company fired me. Didn't ask me how many meetings I was going to or anything. Or how big my talk was. He fired me because I wasn't doing anything there for me. Part of the thing was to take my car, because the car was part of the job. It's kind of like being in jail. I had one phone call, and I called my wife to come pick me up. Because I was fired. Good AA like me. I walked out there on the corner of the lot, and this is the ego, corner of the lot, and it was about 11 o'clock in the morning, and I was waiting for Kay to come pick me up. And it occurred to me, that people driving by would probably suspect I was fired. This is the kind of ego I have. I swear. So I started looking important. I checked my watch, you know, looked busy and just kind of stood up straight. You know. I'd just been fired. I had a mortgage and two young'uns. And my biggest worry is some guy would drive by and punch his wife. I bet that one's fired. So I got in the car and wine and everything. The important thing about that incident was that I hated that job. I should have quit a long time ago. They should have fired me a long time ago. And that thing opened, I don't mean the next afternoon or the next week, but over the years, that opened up for me job-wise, employment-wise, things beyond my wildest dreams. And a lot of the so-called losses that we experience, the so-called tragedies, the so-called pain are just those things. Those things that force me to drop something that's killing me anyway. To be rid of some yoke or some burden anyway. And only when it's so painful to hold on will I drop it. To clear the way for beautiful and wonderful things. Everything that's good in my life. And thanks to you, that's much. Everything of value, everything worth showing you. Is a direct result of this program. There's nothing else. There are no other tricks up my sleeve or anyone else's that I know. This fellowship that I described, the recipe for living, the therapy implied in those 12 steps, and that's what it is. Dr. Silkworth calls it a moral psychology. But God, I found it. And for that, I thank you.